nanohub.org. You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Thank you very much for that overgenerous introduction, I should say. It's a pleasure to be back. I think the last time I was here was probably five or six years ago. I came in last night, and I was entertained to breakfast, and I've been going around ever since. You guys see the place every day, and it sort of incrementally changes. It's quite striking for me. I have a snapshot image of what it was like here of the order of 5 years ago, and I now superimpose on it the snapshot of today. And I have to tell you, by the time we get to 4:05, I am very excited and very impressed with what I'm seeing. And I think I'd like to pay tribute to Alex and to the whole team here. You not only moved on, you've moved up several gears. And I would say on an international scale, the work I've seen here is truly exciting and original and innovative. And I've met young and old faculty with real excitement and enthusiasm for what they're doing. I knew you guys were good. As a result of today, I've got to revise my rating distinctly upwards. So thank you for a very stimulating and challenging day here. In terms of what I'm going to talk about, Alex has set the scene. I attributed down the years to the work of the group. We've had more than 30 people complete PhDs and many postdocs and visitors through, and we're quite international. We've had strong collaborations across the globe, as you see there. I should also, as I have an obligation to declare an interest here, because in the process of developing this new instrumentation, we set up a little spin-out company, originally called Kinbrisk Neutroi. We were going to change it to Intergalactic Mega Enterprises, but in the end we just settled for Oxford Nanoscience. And that became part of a group which floated on the British stock market a couple of years ago, but has now been bought up by Imago, a company based in the USA. So I and my family and colleagues, we're shareholders in Polaron, and in turn Polaron is a stakeholder in Imago. So in the interest of transparency, I must declare that I and my family and colleagues have a business interest in this field as well as a scientific one. What I'm going to talk about, philosophical introduction about materials design. Then I want to do a mini tutorial on exactly how this field on microscope atoprobe system works. I'm going to assume that most of you here have not encountered it before. So for those of you who have, you can have micro sleep. And then I'll talk about the modeling methods we use and then some case studies and a little bit about new applications at the end. The first part I'll just talk about from this slide, knowledge requirements for materials design. What we need to know is where the atoms are, what they are, and how they move when we do things to them. Those are perhaps the key things that we're after. The experiments that we can now do with the atom probe enable and what kind of atoms we've got, and it's really the computer modeling that is enabling us then to link that in to how they move around and what happens if you do heat treatment, deformation, irradiation, deposition, or whatever. So if you put these things together, you've got quite a powerful package. When we started on Atom Probe, we were viewing it really as a materials characterization technique. But what we now have is an extraordinary and unexpected strong synergy has emerged between what we can do with 3D atomic scale experiments and what the guys in the computer labs can do with 3D atomic scale modeling. Put those two together, you not only have characterization, basically you have a materials design tool, you have a materials development tool, you have a way of predicting the long-term lifetime. For example, one of the applications is that a lot of the atom probes around, there are now 25 of these 3D atom probes around the world. We built the first ever successful one. But one of the key applications is studying safety and structural integrity of nuclear reactor steels. And in that case, it's absolutely vital to know how these steels are going to behave on the timescales of 50 to 100 years. And we don't have 50 to 100 years to do those experiments, okay? So we need to be able to use the characterization techniques we've got to use those to validate computer models. And then a lot of the what if and extrapolation questions can only be dealt with in the computer. But we can't trust the computer unless we can root the computer models in real hard experimental data. And what the 3D atom probe is enabling us to do is to get that for on the atomic level. Right, tutorial session then. Most of you will have seen pictures like this many, many times before. They're on the covers of every solid-state physics textbook published in the last 20 years. Each dot on an image like that is one the image of one single atom magnified about 100 million times on the screen. This is a platinum alloy catalyst surface. You notice the dots are arranged in rings. The rings are arranged in concentric families, and there are multiple intersecting systems. And it's pretty near incomprehensible, isn't it? That's not the most easiest picture to understand. What's going on? Well, the field eye microscope looks like this. It's a needle-like sample that we're looking at instead of a flat thin film. So that's a piece of a metal or a semiconductor which is either electrolytically, chemically, or by iron milling sharpened into very sharp point, less than 100 nanometer end radius. We do several things to this point. We put it into a vacuum system, typically ultra-high vacuum, 10 to the minus 10 torr. We cool it down to about 50 degrees Kelvin to stop the atoms moving around on the surface. We apply a high voltage to the surface, typically up to 10,000 volts positive applied to this needle. So we have a very, very high voltage on a very, very sharp point. That generates a huge field gradient at the apex of the order of tens of volts per nanometer. So there's an appreciable potential drop across the diameter of one atom. Very, very strong. And then into the vacuum system, we put a very small trace of an inert gas, usually neon. This, in the presence of that very, very high field, any neon atom which comes close to the apex of that tip is likely to become ionized. And the polarity is such that the tip is positive, and therefore the ionization process will essentially drag an electron off the neon atom into the solid, leaving a positive neon ion, which then will be repelled away pretty well radially from the end of that needle. And about 10 centimeters away from the needle, there will be a phosphor screen, and on the screen there will be this little constellation of imaging atoms that Alex so vividly described, which represents the surface. If the end of this needle, if it had been a perfectly smooth, uniform hemisphere, then the ionization over that surface would be essentially uniform. There'd just be a green or blue glow on the screen, and I wouldn't have a job. Okay, it gets interesting when the end of that needle is not totally smooth, but is knobbly or irregular. If there's locally a little protrusion or asperity, something which sticks out, then locally more ions will form. And corresponding to that, the ions are roughly radial trajectory, so corresponding to a little lump on the tip, there will be a bright splodge, a bright area on the screen. And the art and science of field eye microscopy involves shrinking that needle down to the point where it's so sharp that you can't think of it as being smooth. It's lumpy because it's made up of atoms. And if it's sharp enough, the individual atoms act as sufficient perturbations to modulate the ionization intensity and produce the sort of image that you saw on the screen a moment ago. Understanding the images, well, this is the process that's going on. That's a sideways view of one of these needles. We've got a gas atom outside here. It's polarized by the strong electric field. It's being drawn into the surface. Quite a complicated series of things happen. They arrive on the surface. The surface is cold, they get thermally accommodated, they dance around on the surface, and if the field is high enough, eventually that atom is ionized, the gas ion heads off towards the screen, the electron passes into the solid. And there's a region, a critical surface, about 4 angstroms above the surface, where the ionization is concentrated, and most ions will be formed above these edge, step, corner, kinksite atoms on the surface. There's a further complication. Some of the gas atoms are adsorbed on the surface, so the images that you see is actually of a gas-covered surface, but we'll skate over that for now. Field ionization, the physics of what's happening is quantum mechanical. The gas atom is ionized by a tunneling process. This is real-life quantum mechanical tunneling. There's a barrier about 0.4 of a nanometer wide. The electron tunnels through into the metal, and the gas atom is repelled away. And that's why there's a critical distance. If the gas atom is too close to the surface, there won't be a vacant state for the electron to tunnel into. So the ionization is occurring about 0.4 nanometers above the surface. And that's the critical distance shown there. To understand the image, well, this is before the days of computer simulation. This is 7,246 polystyrene spheres. We actually only built, if you look really carefully, we only built a quarter of that model. There are two mirrors at right angles in there, okay? It makes it more stable against grad students coming by and knocking the whole thing over. If you try to make a hemisphere out of the repeating unit cell structure of a crystalline material, then the locus of intersection of any atom plane with a spherical envelope will always be a ring. Okay, so the most geometrically, the most prominent atoms will always lie around the edges of rings. That's where the step edges and the corners lie. This particular structure, this is face center cubic. The vertical axis is 001. Down to the left-hand side here is 111. This is 110. This is 11 bar 1. That's a 11 bar 3 plane. So all the different each crystal orientation will give rise to a set of a concentric family of rings on the surface, and the different orientations will produce the spherical pattern. That's how these very beautiful geometrical structures arise. I've shown a perfect crystal so far. One of the nice things, and the links in with what Alex was doing and what his supervisor, David Smith, was interested in, crystal defects and grain boundaries. One of the things, if I light this up, there you can see the trace of a grain boundary. If I take the line off again, you can see the discontinuity in the image. And historically, the field arm microscope was really the first technique which showed that in metals, at least, grain boundaries are essentially atomically sharp. Before that, people thought there was an amorphous region there. But this was the first graphic demonstration that it wasn't like that. Obviously, we can see the structure of defects, but obviously the other thing we want to know is the chemistry. What's there? What's segregated at the boundary? And this is where the microscopy runs out of steam, because unfortunately all atoms look roughly the same. This happens to be a tungsten specimen, but if there was oxygen or phosphorus or sulfur or antimony or something at that boundary, then we can't tell from the microscopy that it's there. So we need something on top of the microscopy to identify the atoms. And for once, nature has been really very kind to us. It's provided us with a means to do this. And the process that's involved is called field evaporation. And this is a little bit of basic physics here. This is a set of potential energy curves. Vertical axis is potential. Horizontal axis is distance going out from a metal surface. And the green curve here represents the binding energy curve for a neutral metal atom sitting on a metal surface. And that, of course, requires a sublimation energy lambda to thermally desorb it, typically several electron volts. So it's nailed down pretty heavily on the surface. That's the ground state. We can draw an infinite number of possible excited states for that atom, which will be metastable, will be above the ground state. This is one where we assume that, for example, the atom is in the form of a positive ion sitting on the surface rather than a neutral atom. Generally speaking, that will not be a stable state. There may be exceptions in the case of things like alkali metals or tungsten, but normally that's not going to be stable at all in the absence of a field. And the horizontal asymptote will also be higher. In that case, instead of going off at energy zero out here, the asymptote for the desorption of an ion will be raised, but if it's an n-fold charged ion, the asymptote is moved up by the summation of the ionization potentials to the nth degree, less n times the work function, which is the energy you get back when you put the electrons into the solid. So that will normally not happen. However, let us now put on this enormous field that we've talked about, volts per nanometer. Okay, this is going to rewrite the rule book. You have a potential which drops dramatically even across the diameter of an atom. The effect of that strong field on the neutral atom state is really quite small. You can think of it as a polarization energy correction. It's not no big deal. But the effect of that field on the ionic state is absolutely huge, because the surface over here on the left-hand side is a positive electrode. It gets more negative as you go away from the surface. We're talking here about a positive ion. Its potential is going to become lowered as it moves away. And the key thing it does, it changes the asymptote. Instead of the asymptote for the ionic state being the horizontal line here, the asymptote for the ionic state becomes the field line. And so the net resultant is that the blue curve for the ionic state is now transformed into the red state. And now you have an entirely new possibility for removing material from the surface of the sample. If you think of an atom that's just simply vibrating around thermally on the surface here, it doesn't have to go all the way up this curve, require several EV of energy to get off. If it can reach this crossover point here and undergo a radiationless transition from an atomic to an ionic state, it can now dissolve as an ion. And this is why this is called field evaporation. Okay, it's material evaporating from the surface, but it's evaporating very unusually in ionic rather than neutral form, and this can only happen in the presence of a very strong electric field. And of course, we have control of this electric field because we can crank up the voltage on the sample. So I've drawn this with an intersection a little way up that curve. If I turn up the voltage sufficiently, I can bring that crossover point down virtually to the minimum of the potential energy curve. So a material like tungsten, which normally you couldn't thermally desorb until 3,000 degrees Kelvin, you can field evaporate tungsten at huge rates at 20 degrees K just by turning up the voltage. Mean rates of meters per second can be achieved at high rates. So you can strip off atoms in spectacular fashion. And they're coming off as charged ions, and this is now the basis for chemical analysis. And the key phrase that comes up next is mass spectrometry. A mass spectrometer needs an input, which is charged ions. So if we strip these ions off the surface, feed them into a mass spectrometer, we can find out what they are. So the chemical analysis is inherently destructive. We can't analyze the atoms where they sit. We've got to pick them up. And then the mass spectrometer is effectively a weighing machine. We find out what the atoms are by picking them up and weighing them one at a time. A single atom of iron weighs 10 to the minus 22 grams, and we can measure it accurately enough to find out what isotope it is. That's the way we do it. While I'm still on this slide, I will just mention one additional thing. Plugging the numbers in here, typically, if the sample is at 50 degrees Kelvin, if we set the field so that the surface is stable, we've probably set this so that this crossover is maybe half an electron volt above the base. That's sufficient to trap the atoms. If we pull it down to about 0.1, 0.15 electron volts, then even at 20 degrees K, the stuff will come off. But the other thing we can do, which we don't need to do for metals, but is very, very relevant to semiconductors and less conductive materials generally, is that instead of pulling this barrier down to zero, the other possibility is to tickle the atoms a little bit, okay? Give them a little bit more energy so that they can get over about a 0.5 EV barrier. And you can do that with a laser pulse. Okay, so you apply, it used to be a nanosecond, these days it would be a picosecond or femtosecond laser pulse. And it's not one of these, there are laser mass analysis techniques where you blast the sample and generate a plasma with temperatures of several thousand K. You don't do this here, you just tickle the atom slightly and you bring the temperature up momentarily from about 50 degrees K up to around about 300 degrees K. So the thing is very, very stable. But if you laser pulse this up to about 300K, you can get the atoms to come off. And so recently, very high-frequency lasers have become available, and we are now going back into the semiconductor analysis business in a serious way, and I'll talk about that at the end. But anyway, this is the basic physics, then, of what's happening. And the original atom probe was developed at Penn State University here in the States by Owen Mueller. And the way he set it up, there's the needle. This was the original image screen. He cut a hole in the screen, in real terms about 2 millimeters across. And he put a flight tube behind that with a particle detector at the end of it. And the best spectrometry technique he used was time of flight. And there's a particular reason for doing this. Most of the mass spectrometers you've come across will be things like combined electric and magnetic field instruments where you have curved trajectories and then a slit and a collector, and you sweep through a mass range and build up a spectrum. Now, that's okay if you've got a steady feed of ions. That sort of deflection spectrometer, however, will not work if you've only got one ion that you're trying to analyze. Because unless you know in advance what that ion is, you can't tune the spectrometer so that it goes through the hole. So if you don't get a signal, all you know is what it wasn't. Okay. The nice thing about time of flight techniques is that this is essentially an aperture-less mass spectrometer. What you do is that you apply a nanosecond pulse to the needle on top of the DC. You may have 10,000 volts DC present. You apply an extra 2,000 volt amplitude, one nanosecond rise time pulse. And in that nanosecond, you zap atoms off the surface. The atoms are ionized, they're accelerated towards the screen. They lose potential energy, they gain kinetic energy. Kinetic energy is half mv squared. So a heavy atom will have a slow velocity, a light atom will have a much higher velocity. And if you measure the total flight time from the tip to a detector, which may be 50 or 100 centimeters away, that will tell you what the mass to charge ratio of the atom is. And it covers the entire mass range from zero to infinity, because after you've zapped the tip, you just wait however long it takes to get at the ion at the other end. So that was the American concept, brilliantly simple in principle. There are a couple of practical problems. One is that the entire flight time is only of the order of a few microseconds. So you have to time to a nanosecond or better to get this to work. It used to be difficult. You now go down to an electronic supermarket and buy the stuff to do that, no problem. The second thing, difficulty, is related to the fact that this is a destructive technique. So the atoms, when you zap the sample, atoms fly off in all directions, and you only catch the ones that go through that little hole. Now, the screen is about roughly 7 centimeters diameter. The hole is 2 millimeters diameter. This is a really tough way to get your PhD if you're a grad student. Every 1,000 atoms you knock off that sample, one goes through the hole. The other 999 go splat into the screen. So in Alex's time, we had some seriously dedicated students working with this sort of technique to get their degrees, who did some pioneering work. However, we felt that there had to be a better way to do this. Let's just run the maths very quickly. I've talked about this. The potential energy loss for the ions becomes kinetic energy. So the mass to charge ratio of the ions is 2 eV, t squared over d, t over d squared. V is the accelerating potential. E is the electronic charge. T is the flight time. D is the flight distance. Very, very simple algebra. We got lazy. We felt there had to be a better way of doing it. Several groups in the world felt there had to be a better way of doing it. We all set out to try and do it. We got there first. We built the first successful 3D atom probe in Oxford. And you can see what we've done here. Basically, we have thrown away the screen with the hole in it. We've now pushed the detector up closer to the needle, and we've opened the detector out so that it's got a large area, so that it can capture atoms that are being emitted over a large solid angle from the needle. So that solves the problem of only catching one out of 1,000. Okay, we can now catch a bigger number. But of course, if the only thing we do is increase the area of the detector, what this has done is killed stone dead our spatial resolution. Because what the aperture hole was doing was selecting the area for analysis. We could tilt the sample around so, for example, a grain boundary was lined up over the hole. If we're analyzing the whole area, then we've scrambled everything up. So it only makes sense to do this if you install a smart detector. And it's got to do two things at the same time. It's got to measure the time of flight to tell you what the atom is, and it's also got to give. It's got to be position sensitive. It's got to read out the XY coordinates of where the atom hit. And since the trajectories are essentially radial, if you know where it hit, you can map back to where it came from on the surface. In practical terms, this is quite challenging. One of the analogies for the flight time, this is a 2,000-volt amplitude pulse, okay? It's a splendid misprint in the literature which says the specimen was electrically insulted to 20,000 volts, and it meant insulated. But anyway, you seriously insult this sample. So up here, bang, 2,000 volts, okay? Across here, blip, about a few microvolts. So your time of flight signal is like listening for a pin drop shortly after a bomb has gone off. Okay, many orders of magnitude difference between those two. And the other second difference is that the flight time signal essentially comes out and is processed as a digital signal. The position sensing thing is usually an analog type signal that's coming out. So you have the electrical engineering involved in this is non-trivial, but it can be done. When you've done it, then you can do it with amazing accuracy. So this is an example. This is a mass spectrum from a stainless steel with all kinds of things present in it. This is just part of the mass to charge range. This is a log scale. That's one count there. That is 60,000 counts up there. Okay, so there's 4.5 decades here. We're color-coding things. The red, these are doubly charged ions. The iron in the stainless steel, mass 54, 56, 57, those are the three iron isotopes. The mauve ones here, those are the isotopes of chromium. The blue ones are the nickel isotopes. Tucked in here, with only about 1% amplitude, is the small amount of molybdenum in that stainless steel. And in here are traces. That's a trace of vanadium. Across here is a trace of cobalt. The quantitative accuracy of this, the technique, is amazing. A very recent story, we have a project on environmentally assisted cracking of stainless steels. We had samples of stainless steels delivered to us from a commercial supplier with a certificate of analysis. We ran them through the atom probe. We found things that were not on that analysis certificate. In particular, 0.5% copper, a trace of cobalt, trace of vanadium that were not in the specs. And we went back, we challenged our supplier. We said, we are finding things in the atom probe that you haven't told us about. And we insisted that they re-examine the chemical analysis. And what they'd done, they'd put a worksheet through to their own analysis people, and they'd only asked them to analyze for specific elements, which were the ones that were supposed to be in the steel. When they went back and did a complete analysis for metallic trace elements, they had to apologize, and they've got to replace the entire batch of steel. This is a very, very accurate, extremely sensitive technique, and is capable of doing seriously quantitative analytical work as well as producing pretty pictures. That was a log scale. Just to emphasize this, this is the same data now plotted on a linear scale. Remember that this went up on full scale, it went up to 60,000 counts. Okay, so this version of it only goes up to 140. So the full scale of this spectrum is 300 times off scale, okay? And the noise level is down there, okay? We have a signal-to-noise level which is favorable by about 10 to the 4 to 1. So very, very low background noises. We can pick up trace elements very, very effectively in this technique. And interestingly, because it's a mass spectrometer, it will pick up light elements as well as it'll pick up heavy elements. Okay, doesn't matter where you are. So this is the silicon in the stainless steel. That's the purple one. Blue is the impurity phosphorus in the steel. Yellow is a trace of sulfur in the parts per million range. And the peak there, that's actually out of the background system in the microscope in this case, but that's hydrogen. So the technique will pick up everything literally from hydrogen to uranium. It's a complete spectrum analyzing facility. Coming to the 3D bit, if you remember the picture I showed of the reconstruction of a hemisphere, if you chip away at this tip, it'll always be the most prominent atoms that are picked off first, the ones that were labeled white on the diagram. And they were around the edges of circles. So if you pick off the white atoms, then you shrink the circle a little bit, and you replace them with another set of white atoms that were next in. So if you sit and watch this, you actually see these rings dissolving away one after another. It's a sequential removal of atoms, and it takes off layer after layer. And so what you're doing in the computer is that you're reconstructing all this. You apply hundreds of... typically these days would be pulsing at 200 kilohertz. You build up in the image, a 3D image in the computer of one layer after another. A current generation instrument is capable of picking off something like 100 million ions in an hour. So we're knee-deep in atoms now. We've got so much data, we're on the limit of what any conventional computer can process in real time. So we have 3D real space reconstructions on the scale of 100 nanometers. This is really equivalent to a serious amount of proportion of a section through a TEM thin foil. But it's in 3D and we've got all the atoms there. So, you know, the sample sizes are now big enough to compare to electron microscopy, and the 3D data is a dream for the computer analysis. Now then, I have a movie here, and what I would normally do is move a pointer onto that graphic and go click, and it would run. Let's just see if I can make this happen. Here we go. Right, a eureka. What this is a part of a car body, okay? It's an aluminium alloy, lightweight car body, 6000 series, aluminium, magnesium, silicon with copper addition. It's been heat treated to produce a nanometer array of precipitate particles. That's what provides the strength. In this particular sample, this is a fairly small area. This was done by a final year undergraduate doing a short project. It's that easy to use the machine. That analysis includes about a total of 800,000 atoms. Most of them are aluminum. We've left those invisible. We're not really too worried about the aluminum. We want to know really where things like the magnesium and the silicon are. And these form nanometer-scale rod-like precipitates, and those rod-like precipitates are aligned along the 001 type cube directions. And if you look carefully at that going around, you can see all three orthogonal 001 directions are represented with the particles. There's an amazing amount of information here, even on a relatively small area. We can measure how many particles there are, the size of the particles, the size distribution of the particles, the shape of the particles, the shape distribution of the particles, the composition of the particles, whether there is anything segregated at the interface between the particle and the matrix. And also, and surprisingly interesting, we can measure the matrix composition. That seems to be the boring bit, okay, between the particles. In fact, it's one of the most important things because the matrix chemical composition is the measure of the chemical potential of each of the solutes. And so in terms of linking through to the thermodynamics and predicting what will happen if you do different heat treatments of this material, that matrix composition is at least as valuable as the precipitate composition. So that's the basis for the 3D microscopy.
What's the accuracy on the spatial position?
Yeah, okay. That's my next sentence. Thank you for asking the question. It's perfect. I've left out the aluminium atoms here, okay? But I think there's one or two later that I will show. If we put the matrix atoms in, then, in fact, the reconstruction is sufficiently accurate. We can see the major lattice planes, okay? And the sort of thing that we've been doing in Oxford is taking the 3D data, for example, from a dilute alloy, and doing a Fourier transform on it. And we can produce a diffraction pattern showing the major crystallographic spots. And we can run this like a dark field. We can do the equivalent. We can do a virtual electron microscope experiment. Having got the diffraction pattern, we can rotate the whole thing, tilt it so we're oriented for one set of lattice planes, flick back into real space, and then we'll see those lattice planes sideways on. The resolution is better. It's not isotropic resolution. The resolution is better vertically, because you have to strip one player lane off before you get to the next. Laterally, there's a bit more scatter because the atoms can have a transverse velocity component when they come off the surface. So it's better than two. It's of the order of an angstrom vertically. The smallest planes, the limit of in tungsten, for example, no problem resolving the two angstrom spaced 110 planes. Okay to resolve the 112, which is about 1.5 angstrom, and you can just about see the 222 planes just on the limit, which are 1 angstrom apart. That's about the limit for it. Laterally, it's a bit less, and there are distortions close to grain boundaries or particles, which are quite complicated. But if you rely on the Fourier transform, you'd say that the lateral resolution was of the order. Well, it's certainly better than half a nanometer. In most cases, it's better than 0.3 nanometers. So it's of the order an atom spacing. Right. This, again, unfortunately, this is tilted at exactly the wrong angle. But this is the sort of thing you could do on a current instrument. This is a nuclear reactor, pressure vessel steel, which has been aged for about 5 years. In that case, the lateral The base of that analysis is about 80 nanometers across. The height of it is about 150 nanometers, and it's a big enough field of view to see a whole bunch of precipitate particles instead of just the few that I showed before. That's a healthy number of particles showing up. Let's now link this across to the computer simulation. You need a whole bunch of things to do the computer simulation properly in these complicated alloys. The simplest approach is to use a pairwise interaction model, and in that case, at the very least, you need all the atom-atom interaction energies, both self and every permutation of binary interaction that you can get, like and unlike interactions. You also need vacancy solute interactions. In the area in which this sort of approach works best and then leads into Monte Carlo simulation is in the case of steels. We can simulate a remarkable number of processes connected with precipitation, aging, spinodal decomposition, a whole range of things in steels atomistically using pairwise interaction potential. Steels seem to be pretty user-friendly from that point of view. In the case of titanium alloys, life is altogether more difficult. They just don't respond to pairwise calculations, as many of you will know. We have to use first principles cluster calculations for every configuration. But what we do in that case is we have a lookup table. If we're simulating atom movements, we will have a library of 8 or 9 or 10 atom cluster configurations with their energies, and we can compare the energies when we move around. Aluminium alloys are quite varied. The GP zones in things like aluminium, zinc, magnesium are pretty easy to get hold of. The aluminium, magnesium, silicon is more complicated because you really need chemical potentials for the Mg2Si phase. And the thing that's most difficult for us, of all for us at the moment, is to deal with things like aluminium, copper, where the strain energy term is large. Now, there is some progress there, and it's not from our laboratories. It's from somebody that both Alex and I know very well indeed, Adrian Sutton, who is now a professor in London. And what he's been coming up with very recently are some very lean, mean algorithms to estimate the elastic strain energy contributions around arbitrary configurations of spheres or plates or needles. And so we haven't yet done it. But looking at what Adrian is now doing, to the extent to which I'm capable of understanding his mathematics, I am now a lot more optimistic than I would have been if I'd given this talk a year ago, that we can now do computer modeling, factoring in realistic elastic strain energy terms as well. That is now within reach. So the kinetic Monte Carlo models that we use, typically, at the moment they're strain-free, and they're basically their atom vacancy swaps. With a migration probability depending on the energy change associated with the swap. We have to use Monte Carlo rather than molecular dynamics because we're interested in things happening out to 50 years. Okay, it's as simple as that. We don't have any choice in this. What we're doing it's essentially the algorithm that we use. If we consider a place exchange, if it lowers the energy of the system, we'll accept it. If it raises the energy of the system, we'll accept it conditionally with a probability which is e to the minus delta E over RT, what's called a Metropolis algorithm. And this works remarkably well, in fact. So, for example, these are some experiments here for a very simple binary alloy, copper cobalt, aged for different periods of time, but 450 centigrade. There's 30 minutes, 1 hour, 24 hours. You can see it's obviously non-random after 30 minutes. It's hard to identify particles. By the time you get to an hour, you're beginning to see nanometer-scale particles. By the time you've got to 24 hours, experimentally, the particles are growing. The matrix concentration of solute is well down. If we model that with this kinetic Monte Carlo approach, it's amazingly good. Let's put it modestly, we can get within one order of magnitude for the number density of precipitates and for the evolution of the solute concentration with time. And if any of you have ever worked on nucleation theory, if you can get within one order of magnitude, you're doing brilliantly well. Most of Rowan's results are actually within a factor of two or three of the experiments. So in a nice user-friendly isotropic system with small strain energies, we can do a lot of nice things. One of the things that I'll mention in this context is that it's very clear when we look even at unaged material experimentally that it's not random. We have never yet succeeded in producing a completely random solid solution. Okay, and in the words of a former director of the US Steel Research Lab, the Bain Lab in Pittsburgh, he said, there is no such thing as a random solid solution. And I'm inclined to agree with him. But one of the issues is the starting state for these aging. Why is it non-random? And these materials have got complicated histories. They've usually been homogenized at high temperature. They've then been cooled, and they've then been held at room temperature. And those stages are very difficult to access experimentally. So one of the things that we can do with the computer modeling, other than going in the direction of very long-term aging, we can work back in the sequence. If we've got a model that works and that we believe in and that matches our experiments in accessible time ranges, we can now plug in a whole different set of parameters. We can, in the computer, solution treat that alloy at a fixed temperature. We can quench it at varying rates. We can hold it at room temperature, notionally, for varying times. And we can see at what stage in the treatment process the non-randomness is coming in. And in many cases, surprise, surprise, cooling rate is of critical importance in this. That's one aspect of it. Then, so we if we work together with the computer modelers, we can attempt to optimize the processing, okay, to get the starting microstructures right. The other really interesting thing with things like spinodal decomposition, for example, is that in the classical theories of spinodal decomposition are all based on continuum matrix compositions, and continuum in that case means uniform. And in the theories, spinodal decomposition starts off really rather slowly because in the initial separation, there's not much gain, not much benefit in free energy. It gets better as you go on longer. When you do the experiments, spinodal decomposition just takes off. It doesn't have any inhibitions about starting up. And so the difference between experiment and theory on spinodals is greatest at the early stage of decomposition. And you ask why, and in that case, it's connected with randomness. Uniform and random are not the same thing when you have a grainy structure. And so in the case of iron chromium, for example, what we find is that the starting state is not far off random, mathematically random arrangement, but a mathematically random arrangement includes regions where solute is clustered together and regions which are depleted. Eric Kram earlier today was telling me about absolutely brilliant class model he's got for checking on clustering. Can I retell the story a bit? He runs a statistics class, and it's based on coin tossing. Everybody in the class is notionally tosses a coin 100 times and prints out the sequence of whether it's heads or tails. But in fact, only half the class actually tosses the coin. The other half of the class fakes the result and just invents the numbers. They all handed their worksheets to Eric, and Eric reckons that in less than 30 seconds, he can spot which half of the class has done the experiment and which half have faked it. And it's interesting. What he's looking for, he's looking for sequences of five or more heads or tails. Okay? Now, the people faking don't have long sequences of the same type. But when you do the proper statistics on random time series, if you have 100 tries at something with equal probability of being a head or a tail, then the expectation is that you will have at least three sequences where there's either five heads or five tails present, and at least one sequence where there'll be six the same. Okay, and that's just purely based on random number statistics. And I think this is one of the most brilliant, simple, elegant, and decisive teaching tools that I've ever heard of. It maps across exactly to what we're doing. We even in a random solid solution, there will be very substantial fluctuations statistically. And a spinodal decomposition process starts with those fluctuations and just takes off. It's not uniform. It's random, but not uniform. So that's the sort of thing that comes out from this. Some of the other applications I'm just going to mention, I'll happily talk about them with people afterwards. If they want, just to say we've been modeling aerospace aluminium alloys. We can look at the aging of the aluminium, zinc, magnesium over a function of time, and we can match that to 3D simulation of at least of the GP zone growth. And again, very, very good linking in. And we can also, there's a time sequence here running from left to right. Just focus on this, for example. One of the things you see in the computer simulation, you can't get out of the experiments, is that, in fact, these precipitates are moving around. That statistically, things are being randomly added and taken away from them. And the particles actually undergo a kind of random walk. And if you have a very high density of particles, then one of the things that occur surprisingly commonly is that two of these encounter each other and merge into one. And it's been speculated about a lot, but coalescence is, in fact, a very significant coarsening mechanism in systems where there's a high density of a second phase. It's very interesting. That's just one of a whole bunch of things that comes out from this sort of study. This is the nuclear reactor case. Again, very quickly, everybody knew that copper caused embrittlement of reactor steels. It precipitates over long periods of time. What really was a big shock was that if you have nickel present in the steel, then that makes things a hell of a lot worse. And that's a real puzzle because nickel doesn't precipitate from iron. It's soluble. So what on earth is going on? Well, Atom Probe to the rescue. These are 3D reconstructions of different stages of aging. That's low nickel steel. That's a high nickel steel. You see more precipitate particles earlier in the high nickel steel than in low nickel. We can zoom in on those particles. In the alloys, they're hybrid. Okay, they have a copper core, but in fact, it's like an eggshell. There is nickel around the edges of the particle, and also manganese, and a little bit of silicon present. We can do radial composition profiles, and we can do that as a function of temperature, for example. This is the center of the particle. That's the interface. The matrix is out there. We have a big peak, particularly of nickel, at the interface there, and the peak is biggest at the lowest temperatures. That's aged 330 centigrade. That's aged 405 centigrade. This is a classic equilibrium segregation effect at an interface. The lower the temperature goes down, the bigger the enthalpy term is relative to the entropy term, the bigger the nickel effect on the precipitation process. And very, very sobering in engineering terms. Everybody knew that in the age hardening of iron-based alloys, they're used commercially. Weldable iron-copper alloys are used in making submarine hulls, for example. There's major engineering applications for them. Everybody knew that if you threw a bit of nickel in, you got a bit more hardness and it went a bit faster. But when you're deliberately age hardening, you're working at maybe 500, 550 centigrade for a few hours, and the effect is maybe 10 or 20%. In a nuclear reactor, you're down at 300 centigrade, you're running for 50 years. You have totally changed the relative balance of the entropy and the enthalpy term. Instead of a 20% effect, you've got a 200% effect in terms of the hardening and embrittlement. So it's classic interface science, but with major engineering applications. And again, the computer simulation shows exactly extraordinarily good match to the experiments, and we can drive that simulation out to 50 years. We can measure the cooling rate, the pre-treatment, the stress-relieving treatment in the seal. Everything that happens in that seal can be studied in the computer as well as experimentally. What does the nickel do? Going back one. I have a political... You may have to edit this out of the video, but I have a political analogy here. The analogy is the United Nations peacekeeping force in Lebanon, right? The science is that iron and copper hate each other. Okay, they want to keep as far apart as they possibly can. They don't form a good bond along the interface. That's a poorly bonded interface. The iron-copper bonds are weak. Therefore, in surface interface energy terms, that is a high-energy interface. Okay, so the barrier to nucleation is large. In comes nickel, right? It's wearing the blue caps of the United Nations Peacekeeping Force. It's even got the right color in here. Nickel is the diplomat. Nickel makes friends with everybody, okay? It bonds well to copper. and it bonds well to iron. Place the nickel at the interface between the warring factions, the iron and the copper, and you get a good copper-nickel bond, you get a good nickel-iron bond. What you have done is you have lowered the energy of that interface. Okay, the lower energy of the interface means the surface energy term in nucleation has gone down, the barrier to nucleation is less, you get a higher nucleation rate in shorter times. So it's a classic bit of probably sophomore year thermodynamics. It took a large-scale Monte Carlo calculation to figure out what the heck was going on, but the explanation is reassuringly in line with what we know about the rest of science. I'm running out of time. Let me just indicate a couple of other things quickly. These are all bulk systems. Let me just say that we have done a lot of work in conjunction, particularly with Hewlett-Packard and Seagate technologies, on multi-layer thin film structures, particularly the structures which are used in the GMR structures for the read heads of computers. And the vital element there is a 2-nanometer layer of copper. And we can reconstruct this. In answer to an earlier question, that now is showing all the atoms in one of these layers. You can see the successive 111 layers. I think the person who asked the question is gone, but never mind. Those are the 111 layers in the structure. And what you can see, this is a sputter deposited layer. There's intermixing at the interfaces. We've been able to match our experimental data to molecular dynamics modeling carried out at the University of Virginia. On that, we can match uncannily accurately the intermixing. And the interesting thing is, both experimentally and in the computer, there's asymmetry here. There's a top-bottom asymmetry. The growth direction here is vertical. The interface with the iron copper underneath and copper on top of it is sharper than the reverse, where you have copper and you put iron cobalt down. Rather, as with the precipitation in the steels, let's just show the leave that for a minute. Rather, as in the case of the steels, after several thousand hours of highly expensive molecular dynamics simulation, it turns out the scientific explanation of this could be written on the back of a very small postcard in about 3 lines. Okay, it's very embarrassing. We should have thought of it beforehand. It is surface segregation. If you think about the simplest possible approach to surface segregation in a binary alloy, then you ask which species of a binary alloy will segregate to the surface. Well, the surface is a region where there are broken bonds, and it's expensive to break bonds in energy terms. It is very expensive to break strong bonds. It's cheaper to break weak bonds. So in a binary alloy, there's a very simple enthalpy-based argument which says that other things being equal, the species that will segregate to the surface will be the species which is most weakly bonding. Because in that way, the total summation of the broken bond energies at the surface will be minimized. And so if you think about it in this case, if you copper is the weak bonding one, okay, it's got a much lower melting point than iron and cobalt. So if you sputter deposit copper onto an iron cobalt layer, then the sputtering will generate some atomic mixing at the interface, but the copper will want to come back out to the surface. That's where it wants to be. When you now do it the other way around and you have a copper layer and you sputter deposit iron cobalt onto it, it's the other way around. The iron copper wants to bury itself deeper into the surface and drive copper back out. So the deposition process generates an inherent asymmetry in the intermixing. And if you can get that, both experimentally and in the computer, you really have quite a well-benchmarked model. So we've been able to do all kinds of things here. You know, what if? What happens if we change the substrate temperature in this deposition process? What happens if we change the flux of material onto the surface? What happens if we change the sputter energy? We don't have to stop a $500 million production line to do these tests. Once we've got a benchmark model, we can vary the process conditions in the computer and suggest intelligent experiments to the factory. So at this point, as I was saying right at the beginning, we have something which is not just an experimental tool. We've now got to put these two together. We have an atomic scale materials design tool, and that's the way where it's all going. Nearly finished. I mentioned before that we had these two options, voltage pulses versus laser pulses. Voltage pulses are fine for metals. For less conducting materials, then the samples tend to blow apart if you put pulses on them. We can do a lot more with laser pulses, especially with these new fancy femtosecond pulses with 100 kilohertz repetition rates. So, for example, this is what we would call a TMR structure, a tunneling magnetoresistance structure. And in that the barrier there is basically an aluminium oxide barrier. So it's not just a metallic multilayer, it's got an oxide film in it. We had a student who tried to analyze those structures for a year using voltage-pulsed atom probe, and he didn't get a single useful run. When we got the laser installed, in fact, at our spin-out company, he went up there, and in 1 week, he got 4 good runs. So dramatic change in the ability to deal with fragile or less conducting material using laser pulse techniques. This is really where the whole thing is at the moment. There are many obvious applications. One real blockbuster one is measuring on the atomic scale the dopant atoms in semiconductors. Just as I said, continuum models for phase transformation start with a uniform matrix. Pick up any semiconductor book you've ever read, and the assumption is that the dopants are uniformly distributed. Okay. When the devices start coming down below 40 nanometers, that assumption no longer holds. And in the coming generation of nanoelectronics, you are going to have to know where every atom is and whether they're randomly distributed or clustered and how active they are. And this is probably the only technique that is going to be able to do this. So already a couple of semiconductors have moved into this area, and I just heard of a third major international lab that's ordered one last week. So, this is a very, very hot area. And we can do quite fancy things, never mind just silicon. Quantum well structures, quantum dot structures, we can get spectra off really quite complicated ternary and quaternary 3-5 semiconductors. Years ago, we worked on the multi-layer quantum well structures, and had, using earlier laser techniques, we're able to do those. We are now coming back into this field, and other people will as well. The key issue now is quantum dots. Nobody really understands the chemistry of quantum dots, and this is probably the only way to get into it. Quantum wells are easier because they're essentially planar structures, and if you look at them edge-on in the electron microscope, you can get a lot of information. Quantum dot is small, nanoscale, and 3D, and is much less tractable in the EM. It needs a 3D technique, really, to unravel the chemistry of quantum dots, and this is probably the only way to do it. And the most recent thing we've done, the latest paper that we've just published, is based on gallium nitride and gallium aluminium nitride, and looking for solute clustering in gallium nitride-based materials. So a whole bunch of things of that kind. Finally, everything I've said so far has been looking into the bulk of materials. And what we will tend to do, we'll make a needle. We'll put it in the microscope. It goes in covered in, coffee stains, water vapor, CO2, whatever else it is. And the first thing we'll normally do is strip off all this junk. The field evaporation process will automatically remove all the garbage. And we then head to what we would regard as the good stuff underneath. Now, if you're a surface chemist, then what we've just done is absolute sacrilege. They don't care what the boring stuff is down underneath. As far as they're concerned, the good stuff is on the surface. Okay. So one of the really fascinating things now coming out of this technique is, although I'm talking about 3D technique, we're actually beginning to go back out towards the surface. And if you think about it, the end of one of these needles is really, it's a hemisphere stuck on a cone which we can easily pick up and handle. And that hemisphere is it's the best model I know of for a single catalyst particle. So we've got, we are seeing the steps, the edges, the corners on a highly curved surface. And we can do all kinds of things. Okay, that was platinum rhodium. This is that same specimen that's just been exposed to nitric oxide at 573 degrees K for 10 millibars for 15 minutes. That is not the same surface as it was before. Okay, it has restructured, it's faceted. The chemistry of that surface has changed as well. We can, again, section down into it. If we look at the 111 surface, there's very, very strong enrichment of rhodium at the surface, which is hardly surprising. Rhodium is the stronger oxide former. What is surprising is if you do the same experiment on the 001 plane of platinum rhodium, you get the inverse of this. On a sharply curved surface, there is lateral transport taking place. So the oxygen-enriched species are building up in certain areas, and by surface diffusion, they're being depleted elsewhere. So the behavior of these chemical adsorbates on highly curved surfaces is really strikingly different to that on flat surfaces. So there's a whole world there of atomic scale chemical reactions and catalysis that potentially is open to us. And in the limit, this goes right down to molecular adsorption. There is a single 0-1-2 plane of platinum, and there mapped on the left-hand side is where nitric oxide molecules adsorb relevant to that surface. This, therefore, I've talked mainly about 3D material science. I did my PhD in chemistry many, many years ago. We're now coming full circle. We're back to chemistry, guys, and chemistry at the atomic scale. So I finish at that point. I hope I convinced you that this is a powerful technique to study what's going on at the atomic level in solids. The particular power comes when, instead of working in isolation, we work with a bunch of other people. In particular, we get really to grips with collaborating with computer modelers. And at that point, we can begin to go into understanding processing, understanding microstructural stability, microstructural evolution, and ultimately into atomic scale materials design. That's where it's all going. Okay, thank you very much indeed for listening.
It would not be proper if there were no questions. The tradition at Oxford was that questioning of seminar speakers is brutal.
We're much more polite. So early on, you showed these hemispheres and a model where you had white spots where the edges.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
So when you first start doing the iteration or catching, what do you see? Or do you see the edges coming off first?
Yes, okay. In terms of what you're catching, I simplified it a bit in the presentation. What you're actually doing is you're building up information about several layers at the same time. Within the field of view, all the layers are dissolving away, and at any one time, you're catching the atoms from around the edges of all those layers. But you can tag them. You've got enough information there to be able to follow in the computer the collapse of each successive atom layer. You know the rate from the voltage that you're operating at. That tells you what the radius of curvature of the tip is, and therefore you have enough information to reconstruct the planar geometry from the sequence that the atoms are coming off in. So I simplified it a little bit by saying that we were reconstructing one layer at a time. Yes, we are doing that, but during the actual course of the experiment, we are incrementally getting information from several atom layers at once. So, yeah, you've spotted the right... you're thinking along exactly the right lines.
So when you do the time-of-flight calculations, do you have to know what the mass is to some window? Because time-of-flight from one spot is a little different than another spot.
Yes. Okay, you're definitely thinking. Yeah, you said there were going to be good questions here. You were right. Yeah. Yes. The point of origin is negligibly different. They're only nanometers apart. What is different is that the trajectory along the axis is shorter than one off the axis. Okay, so the different starting points on the samples don't matter, but the geometry between the tip and the detector does, and you have to compensate for that. But again, that's just simply Pythagoras. You know where it hit the detector, so that's just one line in the program to do that.
So I have two questions. Can that detector be hemispheric or centered at the tip of the
vortex? Yes, it can be. The people have used, John Panitz at Sandia Laboratories used a hemispherical detector. He was the only guy who could afford to do so. The detectors that you're using are cascaded microchannel plates. Okay, so one ion goes in at one side, and about a million electrons come out the other side. So they look like fiber optics plates, but each plate, instead of being made up of a set of solid fibers, is made up of billions of microscopic hollow tubes, each one of which is a miniature electron multiplier. And you use two or three of these in sequence in a chevron configuration to generate a cascade of electrons. And these microchannel plates are fabricated using fiber optics technology. And normally you'll make a great block of this stuff and then slice the plates out. It's a very complicated technology to then put a curvature in. It costs a fortune. And it also, if you do that, you then have to work at a fixed distance, because it only makes sense to do that if you're working at one distance. And in some cases, we want to be able, for example, to zoom in and out a little bit. So in practice, it's easier to have a flat detector and simply use an extra line in the computer program to allow for to compensate for the off-axis trajectories. But yes, it is possible to use a curved detector if you really want to. It's just that we've moved away from doing that over the years.
Okay. And the second question. Can you imagine nanocrystalline?
Yes. A lot of work has been done on this by different groups. With nanocrystals made by different routes, okay. People have looked at structures that were initially metallic glasses that were crystallized to produce mixed crystalline. Nanoquasicrystalline amorphous structures. The ones we've looked at were made a different route. We've been particularly interested in electrodeposited nanocrystalline materials, not least because these are, they're low cost to produce. You get a bulk in one go. You don't have any of the environmental or health effects potentially associated with dealing with nanoparticles and then compacting them. You get a nanocrystalline. You can make nickel nanocrystalline deposits, for example, which are as hard as a tempered steel. And you just make them in an aqueous bath. In that case, the nanocrystals, the pure nickel nanocrystals, are very subject to grain growth. And so we've done several papers published from us on essentially interface engineering in nickel-based nanocrystalline materials, partly by alloying them or partly by adding, for example, traces of things of phosphorus to pin grain boundaries. It's a very good way to get into nanocrystalline materials, yeah. You just see a whole jigsaw, three-dimensional jigsaw puzzle of nanocrystal grain boundaries.
Can you 3D reconstruction of non-metallic?
Yes. The first we ever did was multi-quantum well structures in 3-5 semiconductors. We looked at gallium arsenide, gallium indium arsenide structures. We could show, for example, this was an industry-funded project. We were looking at structures that were grown by CVD rather than by molecular beam epitaxy. And one of the striking things was that the degree of intermixing between the structure varied from one element to another. Phosphorus was much more mixed up between the layers and the barriers than arsenic was, and the metallic elements were less mixed up than phosphorus was. And we could go back into the processing. We looked at CVD grown quantum well structures from different sources and made by different routes, there was a correlation between exactly how the process was engineered. Particularly the mixing, the gas, you have to switch the gases. Okay, you're trying to do two things in a CVD reactor. For any one layer, you need to properly mix up the gases that are delivering that layer. You then need to change over and deliver another gas mixture to deposit the next layer in the structure. And we could show that depending on how the reactor was engineered. The part of the system that was supposed to be producing gas mixing could actually end up trapping part of that gas and fouling out the next layer. So we could get enough information to.
The reason why I asked you is because you showed two samples of gallium nitride and gallium.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Both of these samples you showed the spectroscopic results. Okay. But if you're trying to do the 3D reconstruction.
Yeah.
You need to detect the non-metallic element.
Yeah, that's right.
Non-metallic element is negative, which is dissociated.
Okay, well, I mean, you know, in terms of the metallic, non-metallic, in the quantum well structures, we could do gallium, indium, arsenic, and phosphorus. Okay. We have the other things we've done in 3D and reconstruction. We've looked at the silicon-silicon oxide interface. We've had high TC superconductors. We've looked at metallization of those. We've looked at oxide films on gallium arsenide. We will be one of a number of groups looking at quantum dot structures shortly. And obviously in the gallium nitride area, we're just beginning there. At the moment, what we're doing is looking for inhomogeneities, lack of randomness in the metallic element distribution. But obviously in gallium nitride, there's going to be a whole bunch of things to do, like what's segregated at the dislocations, for example. Especially in gallium nitride, which is, of course, amazingly durable and resistant to defects and inhomogeneities and impurities that would destroy any other semiconductor. It's a remarkable material, and certainly part of, but not the whole answer to understanding gallium nitride behavior, is to be able to go in and see where all these elements actually are. And yes, you know, the technique is capable of doing that.
The reason why I'm asking this question, even the spectroscopic results that you showed, you cannot detect nitrogen. What you detect is activated species of nitrogen, whether it's N plus or N2+.
No, I mean, we're weighing... The one thing we can't get out of this technique is the chemical state. Okay, for example, in the platinum-rhodium alloys, I can't tell you whether the rhodium is in the divalent or trivalent state. We can weigh the atoms, we can't get the chemistry out. So, in that case, I hope I've indicated all along, we have to work in partnership with other techniques. We can do things which a lot of other people can't do, but we will need spectroscopic tech. You know, you rely on optical spectroscopy techniques of various kinds and electron spectroscopy to get the energy states out. And that then has to be put together with what we do to get the total picture.
The interaction between the various positive ions that fly down and move together, does that interaction cause much of a distortion?
Yes, that's a good question. The something again I didn't go into in great detail. We normally set the ion removal rate very low. So if we're pulsing at 100 kilohertz, then we would be very happy to get just 10,000 ions off in a second. So, you know, which is an average removal rate of, you know, one ion every 10 pulses. So we on the whole, we try to avoid a situation in which too many ions do come off at the same moment. If there are multiple events, then we're better off now with these large area instruments, because if we're looking at 80 or 100 nanometer square area, the chances that two ions have come off from adjacent sites is quite low, and therefore they're not going to, if they're more than a few nanometers apart, they're not going to interact with each other. If you do the sums, by some mischance, bring off on the same pulse two nearest neighbor atoms, then the Coulomb repulsion between the two is strong, and then you will get a distortion. But we would try to be operating two or three orders of magnitude away from any likelihood of that happening. But you're right in terms of the physics. What we have to do is get the engineering correct to avoid that problem coming in.
It's amazing that you get even close to that. I remember when the first time of flight spectrometer was installed in the lab, I used to wander in there. It was set up so that there would be a ping every time an atom was counted. It was like a pea being dropped in a magic bucket. And you walk in the lab and then ping, 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 ping. If you're still counting at those rates, it would have been all easier to get the quantum picture.
Amazing. I'm old enough to go back one generation further on that. I'm not sure I should admit to this. My first apprenticeship in atom probe was at US Steel, where Sid Brenner had a machine.
Yeah.
So I went to learn from him before we built our first one in Oxford. And in those days, the high voltage pulse was generated using a mercury wetted reed relay. And this was in a big box. It was made by a firm called Huggins. And every now and again, this mechanical reed would stick. And so you wouldn't get a pulse. So next to that atom probe on the bench, beside this pulse generator unit, there was a wrench. Okay? And Steve Goodman, who was running this instrument, if the thing stuck, if you were looking through the porthole while he was trying to fix the pulsar, he would hit the pulsar with a wrench. As he hit it with a wrench, an atom would fly off inside the microscope. So we were sort of knocking at it. In those days, we would be happy. When I started, we would be happy to get 150 atoms in an afternoon. And they would be recorded. Their times of flight would be recorded on oscilloscope traces, which would be a storage oscilloscope. We would go home in the evening and we'd figure out what those 150 atoms were and start again the next day. We're now at 100 million in an hour. That's the development in the technique.
I just want to ask a question because the little question was asked on this side.
It's a segregation problem.
Just wonder whether you can comment on the conclusions, even though they may be tentative, about the pattern of composition variations in clusters that you mentioned.
Yes, yeah. Yes, okay. Oh, gosh, that's a big question. Right, probably three or four things to say in this. The materials we're looking at, we're working at large super. You know, we're dealing with systems that have very large supersaturations. That the undercoolings are several hundred degrees, and if we plug the numbers into nucleation theory, for example, in copper cobalt, we're dealing with a system where the critical free energy barrier to nucleation is only of the order of 10 kT. So these are strongly driven systems with critical nuclear sizes of only a few atoms. And because of what I was saying before with Eric Kvam's study of the coin tossing experiment, in a number of these systems that we are studying, we cannot get at the critical nuclear size because it's blasted through that by the time we have anything statistically significant to get. However, David Seidman at Northwestern University is doing some quite exquisite work now on systems with lower supersaturation, and he is getting into exactly that area. In the very heavily supersaturated systems that we are dealing with, we're mainly in the growth and coarsening regime. It is very, very common that we find some matrix atoms trapped in the precipitates. Okay, our copper precipitates always have some iron in, for example. The magnesium silicon ones always have a bit of aluminium in. And we've been doing simulations on this. David Seidman has been doing a lot. I was talking to him at Cincinnati earlier this week. The mixing in the interior of the particles and the extent to which the particle matrix interface is diffuse is related to the fact that we're a long way from equilibrium, and it's connected to the vacancy solute interaction energies. And you can vary. It turns out if you in the computer, if you play around with the numbers you plug in for the strength of the vacancy solute interactions and how preferential these are to one solute species or another, you can simulate structures in which there is varying degrees of matrix material incorporation into the precipitates and varying degrees of diffuseness at the interface. This all straightens itself out eventually as the precipitates grow. The supersaturation decreases, you head into a coarsening regime, everything calms down, and then you head into something which looks much closer to the classical thermodynamics.
I just wondered about, in fact, the possibility of getting some kinetic information.
I'm sorry, I missed that.
Kinetic information.
Yes. There's a huge... I mean, this is just opening up a whole new area. Can I just mention one thing that I didn't talk about? In these steels with iron copper... I showed that, for example, nickel could promote the precipitation by an interface segregation effect. Now, we were just playing games with some of the data. We wanted to do some quality assurance on the data. So Shuichi Hirasawa, the postdoc working on this, started doing statistical tests on the matrix, which has mainly got iron, manganese, and nickel there. And he started to find, to his amazement, that the iron manganese nickel matrix, which you think is as near an ideal solution as you're going to get, certainly wasn't random. There was a less than 1% probability that it was random. We then went across and looked at our accumulated computer simulation models, and lo and behold, we were seeing the same thing there. And we were then able to... The issue then was, how did the iron, nickel, and manganese become non-random? And we went right back, we simulated in the computer, right back through the history of the steel, from the original soaking temperature to the cooling, the tempering, the stress-relieving treatment. And we could see the temperature range in which manganese and nickel began to deviate from randomness. But the range that we're in with the manganese and nickel, I mean, if you look at the details of the iron, manganese, or iron, nickel phase diagrams, there are compounds present at low temperatures. But they're only present at low temperatures, they're only present at high solute concentrations. We've got low solute concentrations and slightly higher temperatures. We are effectively in a range which is above a solvus. We've got transient short-range clustering. We can follow it in the computer now. You can see little groups of manganese and nickel atoms coming together, dissolving away. They're not stable clusters, but if you take any snapshot in time, the structure will be distinctly non-random. And you're now imposing copper precipitation into that matrix. And what we're seeing is that, just as I was saying in the case of the spinodal, spinodals are evolving from a random rather than a uniform structure, and that is affecting the kinetics of the spinodal reaction. Now, in this case, the copper precipitation is occurring, in fact, within a non-random structure. And the initial copper clustering is synergetic with the manganese-nickel non-randomness. But the manganese-nickel non-randomness by itself is ephemeral. But at any moment in time, it is there. And there's a synergy between that and the copper clustering to produce quite a complicated group of atoms to begin with, which then sorts itself out into a copper core and a manganese-nickel surround. So there's a whole bunch. I was suggesting that we had a symposium about nucleation down in Cincinnati, and one of the things that emerged from this was a suggestion that we should, at a future meeting, have a symposium addressing the issue of non-randomness in solid solution alloys. This is absolutely fundamental underpinning of what is happening in real phase transformations. It's very different to what's written in any of the textbooks, but this is the actual reality in these systems. And it becomes, most engineering systems are multi-component. And many of the things that are being done empirically in industry are exploiting these effects.
I agree with you.
But you know, we've at least opened the first page of the book. Okay, we can now at least see the chapter headings and some of the subheadings. The next 240 pages we're going to have to write in the next decade or so, but at least we can see which way it's going.